Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. As a talk radio host, I've interviewed staff from the Discovery Institute about intelligent design and problems with evolutionary theory a number of times over the years, and inevitably a critic would email afterward, citing a website that claimed to feature countless examples in which the Darwinian mechanism caused observed speciation. That website was Talk Origins Speciation FAQ. FAQ, for frequently asked questions. For critics upset with the challenge to established evolutionary theory, these citations were enough to prove any challenges to Darwinism were wishful thinking. Here to talk about it with me is Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute. Casey, I've described how Talk Origins FAQ and things of this kind have had an impact, at least from my experience, and how these kinds of things circulate among the general public. How do you see the impact of the Talk Origins FAQ, frequently asked questions, on the current debate?
Well, I've had many of the same experiences that you've had, David, where I've received many emails over the years where people will just basically copy and paste a URL or some text from a Talk Origins page as if it settles the argument. And I actually at one point created a bumper sticker for these kinds of people that I would email them. I called it the Talk Origins bumper sticker. It says, Talk Origins said it. I believe it. That settles it. And it comes with instructions on how to use. Basically, you go to Talk Origins, you copy a URL, you paste it into an email, and then you call the person you're sending the email lots of nasty names. And you can roam the internet as sort of a Talk Origins troll, having Talk Origins substitute for real knowledge about the debate over evolution. And so, unfortunately, yes, I have seen this speciation FAQ cited many times over the years. The official title of the FAQ is Observed Instances of Speciation. And I've seen many people cite it to claim that large-scale evolutionary change really has been observed to occur, and that therefore the Darwinian mechanism really can do all the things it's claimed.
Right. That's where the confusion comes from, because if you're not focused on science as a regular part of your life, and you hear something the Discovery Institute calls into question from evolutionary theory, and all of a sudden you get deluged with emails that seem to suggest, wow, there's all the science out there that animals, that one kind of animal can change into another kind of animal, and they've even done it in the labs. Here's the proof. For a layperson, that's pretty strong statement, and it causes all kinds of confusion. You've actually gone back to take a look at that, because obviously, if what they're saying is true, then it becomes an extremely important part of the debate. But you took a look at these reports and found something else.
Sure. Well, I had received a couple of emails asking about the Talk Origins Speciation FAQ over the last 6 months or so. And one of the emails I got came in last summer when I had, you know, a little bit of downtime, and I was in the library quite a bit doing some library research, some literature research. So I thought, while I'm there, I'll just download as many papers as I can find that are cited in this Talk Origins Speciation FAQ and go to the original research to see if it backs up the claims that are actually in the FAQ. And this raises an issue that's really key whenever you're debating this issue on the internet or people are citing Talk Origins at you. You see, Talk Origins is famous for something that we in the ID movement call citation bluffing, where somebody will throw out some technical citation from the mainstream technical literature, and then they'll make a claim pertaining to that paper. Well, sometimes that claim might be overstated. And when you go to the original literature, the original paper, you might find it really does not back up or support the sort of grandiose evolutionary claim that the person is making by citing that paper. And so you always have to go back to the original literature and see if the person is guilty of citation bluffing or not. And in essence, after going through the Talk Origins Speciation FAQ, I found that there was a lot of citation bluffing going on. And that's, of course, the difficult thing for a layperson who may not have access to all of these technical papers. They're out there debating on the internet. Somebody copies and pastes a Talk Origins claim, and it's difficult to go back and double check to see if the person is citation bluffing.
I was about to say, we might not even understand the study if we did go back to take a look at it. And they have a lot of different citations. I mean, it's not like there's one or two that they're making this claim. The list goes on for several pages as far as all the different examples that we're supposed to be overwhelmed with this kind of evolutionary progress, so to speak, captured in a lab citations.
Yeah, it presents a very impressive facade until you kind of peer behind the veil and look at what the papers actually say and realize that, as we'll talk about more, David, in the vast majority of cases, the papers are not even claiming that speciation occurred. And in none of the papers that I read, of the ones that I was able to download and find, not a single one showed any significant morphological change had actually occurred.
Why don't we talk about what do you mean by speciation and what do they mean? How should speciation be defined?
Well, for the purposes of this evaluation, I basically adopt the standard biological species concept definition of speciation, which defines a species as a reproductively isolated population. This is the standard definition that you'll find in biology textbooks. I was certainly taught this definition when I took multiple lower and upper division and graduate level courses dealing with evolutionary biology during my studies in science. So this is a very common definition, and I'm perfectly happy to accept this as the definition of a species. The question is, does that imply that if a new species forms, that significant biological change has necessarily occurred? Keep in mind, the title of the fact was Observed Instances of Speciation. Okay, so if we observe speciation, does that really mean that we have observed significant biological evolutionary change taking place? And the answer clearly is no. One of the interesting findings from going through the papers cited by the fact was that a number of the papers actually openly admit that you can have speciation. You can have the production or the establishment of a reproductively isolated population. You can have that without any significant biological change having taken place. I mean, I can go through some of these papers, but that's key.
Give us an example of how that would work, because usually if when someone says to a layperson, hey, we actually observed a new species develop from an existing species, that sounds really impressive. It sounds like, wow, you know, you're leaping from one animal to another. What does it really mean?
That's a really good question, a really good point, David. And let me give an example from some of my own studies. This is not an example that was mentioned in the FAQ, but it's something that's often talked about as an example of alleged speciation. If you look at some of the lakes in Central Africa, like Lake Victoria, you will find lots of species of cichlid fishes. Cichlids are popular aquarium fish. I remember in one evolutionary biology course I took in college, I had to do a report on two species of cichlids, which were thought to be related and descended from a very recent common ancestor. Well, it turns out that these species are almost identical morphologically. So why do they consider them to be separate species? Well, it's because the two populations are reproductively isolated within the lake. What does that mean? Does that mean that you've got one thing that looks like, you know, one fish and then another fish that looks completely different and they just can't find a way to reproduce because they're just so dramatically different? No, not at all. The difference was one species feeds at about 5-foot depth in the lake and the other species feeds at about 15-foot depth in the lake. And so the species, these two populations, they never interact. They always exist basically at different depths within the lake. And so naturally, they're never going to find each other to actually interbreed and produce offspring in natural conditions. So technically speaking, when we define species as a reproductively isolated population, that means that they are technically different species. But morphologically and in just about every respect, these two populations of fish are just about completely identical. And these were the kinds of examples and things that we saw in the FAQ when they would claim that a new species had formed or when they claimed that there had been some study that had produced some kind of biological change. At a morphological level or even at a behavioral level, the differences were really quite small and we did not see significant biological change taking place.
So even among the claims that are listed, what happened was you basically have very close similarity that are no longer breeding together, but you're not having significant structural differences in the organism.
That's exactly right. I mean, the kinds of changes that we're talking about might be the number of times that a fly licks itself per minute and whether whether the females of that group prefer flies that lick themselves more or less. Or we might be looking at sort of artificial experiments where you put fruit flies on a platform in the middle of a tube and the tube is oriented vertically. And you ask, when the fruit fly jumps off of the platform, does it first fly upwards or does it first fly downwards? Now, what does it mean if the fly first goes up or down? I mean, nobody knows, but at least these are sort of traits that we can measure in laboratory experiments and we can use those to then sort of quantify and measure the degree to which flies that fly upward will interbreed and mate with flies that fly downward. And so we can come up with all these sort of interesting, perhaps artificial traits in some cases, and then ask questions about whether a reproductively, quote unquote, isolated population has been achieved. What's interesting is that, you know, even if you do accomplish some reproductive isolation in these cases, you never saw complete reproductive isolation. You never saw in the papers cited by the FAQ, at least the ones that I saw, true reproductive isolation in a complete speciation sense actually taking place.
That's what I was going to ask. So what you're saying is not a single case of the majority of these citations that you actually read the studies for, and not a single case from what you've looked at so far was the reproductive isolation complete, and therefore it doesn't quite fit the definition of a new species or speciation anyway, does it?
Yeah, where you have completely reproductively isolated populations that within themselves can produce completely fertile offspring, basically. And that's the key. I didn't see that. Now, there was one single paper. And when I read this, I thought, huh, this is interesting. Maybe they actually got one here. It dealt with finding different groups of polychaete worms, which I believe that they came from the Los Angeles area along the Pacific coast. And they claimed that after studying these polychaete worms in the laboratory, that they had actually observed speciation taking place. And when I first read this paper, I actually thought, huh, this is really interesting. This sounds like they might have, for this one example, a case of legitimate speciation. Now, granted, the two worm populations are very similar once again. So we're not talking about significant morphological change. We're just talking about satisfying this very trivial definition of a reproductively isolated population. And so I saw this paper and I thought, oh, fine. It looks like maybe they got one here. Then I actually emailed some colleagues, including Jonathan Wells, and I asked them if they would look over some of my thoughts on the speciation fact that I had written up. And Jonathan Wells reminded me, Casey, I actually wrote about the speciation fact in my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design.
I knew I'd heard this one somewhere.
Okay, yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. So you know where this is going. And so I thought, oh my gosh, Dr. Wells, I completely forgot. It's been a couple of years since I'd read the book. Let me go back and look at your book and see what you found. Well, I was encouraged because for the most part, the conclusions I had come to were very similar. In fact, they were pretty much the same as the conclusions that Dr. Wells had come to. But in this particular case, he had actually found a subsequent paper that was published that I was not aware of. And it was a paper where basically the authors of the original study that claimed that the worm species had speciated within the lab, they retracted that claim because they had gone back and done further studies of the original populations in the wild in Southern California, and they found that these were actually naturally occurring species that naturally occurred in the wild. There was no observed speciation within the lab. And for all we know, this is just these were just naturally occurring separate species. This was not a case of quote unquote observed instances of speciation as the fact claims.
Talk Origins just has yet to fix their own citation site in order to correct for the politically incorrect guide to intelligent design, I take it.
Yeah, the retraction paper was actually co-authored by Francisco Ayala, who's a very eminent evolutionary biologist. So you would think that the Talk Origins folks might be paying attention to it, but I guess Dr. Wells was the one who was willing to go back and investigate these claims critically, and Talk Origins just hasn't been doing that.
So despite this vast array of citations that's meant to assert very strongly and intimidate anybody who would disagree with it that Darwinian evolution is the mechanism by which all kinds of different species can be created, and we've observed it all in the lab, it turns out that they have yet to observe with any kind of regularity or clarity any kind of morphological major changes or even full speciation from what you could tell.
This was the finding that I came up with. And again, what we call this in the ID movement, we call this people trying to do a citation bluff. So don't be intimidated by the talk origin speciation fact. That's the lesson here. The other lesson is if you have the means and ability, go back and look at the original citations, the original papers, and see if they really back up what your opponent in debate is actually saying.
You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them.
And most of the time, it's better not to fold them. That's the lesson here.
That's right. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of ID the Future. To learn more or to support the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, go to idthefuture.com and click the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.